Hello, everyone, and welcome to this latest episode of the UKIS ITEL podcast. And joining me today in person, which is nice, is the former BBC parliamentary correspondent, Mark Darcy. Mark, thank you for coming over here and for agreeing to do this.
Great pleasure.
Now, you've had a long and distinguished career. You were correspondent for Today in Parliament, I think, since 2002. You were a presenter and correspondent for the Westminster Hour. How long did you work for the BBC for in total?
I joined the BBC November 1991 or thereabouts. But that was at East Midlands Today, so I was doing regional telly for my first few years and then got catapulted down to Westminster in 1997 when the job I had was abolished in a great sort of editorial upchuck. And So I landed up in Westminster searching for a role and eventually found my way into the fabulous Today in Parliament team.
And had many happy years there by the
time. It's a fantastic team to work with. I sometimes think the BBC doesn't quite know what a jewel it's got there, but day in, day out, whether it's the fall of the government or the committee stage of the Fisheries Bill, You're getting good stuff out of Today in Parliament, rain or shine.
Now, I mean, basically, as far as I'm concerned, you're a sort of walking longitudinal study of Parliament. So don't be surprised with a lot of my questions are about that. And I suppose that, you know, there are so many things I could ask you. But let me start with this. Just in macro terms, how has Westminster changed over your years there? And we'll dig into some of the specifics later, but just big picture stuff.
I think the biggest and most visible change has been increasing numbers of women MPs. And that's not only changed, you know, the look of the place, because it's not all men in grey suits or men in blue suits and varying types of pinstripe. Suddenly, you know, the benches look different. But it's also very much a matter of the issues that get covered in Parliament. Mm-hmm. The focus of Parliament has changed a bit to stuff that, you know, maybe the chaps never thought was important but mattered an awful lot.
Mm.
And so, yeah, and I think that is a change for the good. And the idea that women bring a kinder, gentler politics and it's all soft and lovely and everybody has a group hug, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women in politics have to be tough to survive in politics, and it's a tough world there. And, you know, you have to grow sharp elbows to do it. But there has been a change in focus, and it's been a necessary change in focus, I think, because Parliament was beginning to not sound at all like the rest of the country. And Parliament, perhaps slowly and reluctantly behind, is moving more into line with the rest of society as time goes on and women's influence in Parliament deepens.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It doesn't just depend on where you elect people from. It depends on who and what sort of people you elect.
Of course.
Another thing you hear a lot, I mean, you really do hear this a lot. I tried to press Michael Heseltine on this over the week and he was uncharacteristically reluctant to answer, but that's whether the quality of political debate or of representatives in Parliament has declined over time.
Yeah,
it's really hard to measure, isn't it?
What's the way you measure that? I think that where you see speeches that change people's minds is usually in the House of Lords,
right?
Much more than in the House of Commons, and that matters because a part of the House of Lords process is basically out of the control of the government and bills get amended and ministers are forced into concessions occasionally. So The persuasive ability of someone in the House of Lords can make a huge amount of difference. So when it's someone like Igor Judge, Lord Judge, mm-hmm. or Lord Chief Justice, getting up and making an argument, you can kind of see all those sort of super lawyers in the House of Lords being swayed by what he says, and crossbenchers and occasionally conservative rebels, and suddenly the government's lost a vote on something, and the government's losing rather a lot of votes in the House of Lords. In the House of Commons, not so much, and that's partly because speeches are increasingly time limited. But I don't think I've never believed it's the gross tonnage of words that you utter that mm-hmm. makes the difference. It's the quality of the argument. And I don't think the House of Commons is often all that responsive to the quality of argument. Sometimes it is. But every now and then, you see someone actually lose an argument with a bad speech rather than win an argument with a good speech.
Right, okay. So it's a negative thing rather than... So in thinking back, which are the ones I think about? I mean, some of the speeches in opposition to Iraq, which obviously didn't make much difference because it happened. Jeffrey Howe's resignation speech is one that sticks in my mind. I find it quite hard now to think about the quality of the speech. You can think about what happened following the speech, whether that was anything to do with the quality. But you don't think, and this is even harder to do, but there are some people who say, look, the really talented people no longer go into politics in a way they once did. Do you see any evidence to support that sort of claim?
I think there is a talent problem in Parliament, and I think that you've got to look at who's being selected to Parliament. And I have a feeling that constituency parties from whichever party are often looking for a kind of super councillor rather than the potential prime minister. Who's going to make sure we hold on here? Who's going to make sure that pet local causes are properly treated? Who's going to do that kind of thing? Who's going to turn up at the annual fair? You look back, I used to be an assiduous reader of political diaries. You look back to the Edwardian era and you had a situation where politicians would sort of once every year or so pay a state visit to their constituency and pat a few people on the heads and carry on, you're all doing very well, sort of young Mr. Grace style, and then disappear for another year and were not involved in very much in the way of constituency casework. You talk to MPs now, they're getting thousands of emails every day. And you hear tales of people sort of sitting there at 4 a.m. replying to people's emails because that's the only way they can catch up with the backlog. So the focus of the thing has changed. And they'll also tell you that COVID changed a lot because they were suddenly swamped with all sorts of COVID queries. And people kind of got used to the idea that their MP was there sorting out stuff for them to an even greater extent than had been the case before.
Yeah. And I suppose also, perhaps a bit more cynically, Labour's experience in Scotland was a salutary lesson for MPs, because one of the reasons for the SNP triumph post-2010 was the fact that Labour was seen as remote. Labour MPs were seen as not really giving enough time and effort to their constituents. So I think that provided an incentive. But that raises all sorts of interesting questions, doesn't it? I mean, MPs as local councillors or local mayors, can you see that in Westminster? Do you see, for instance, that fewer MPs attend the debates or fewer MPs are interested in legislation? Do you get that sense?
I get a sense. Well, it's two things. It's not just the level of interest. It's whether you can accomplish anything by being there in those questions. And in the House of Commons, nobody can hear you scream. Yeah, no one can. it's very, very hard. I'll dial back on this ever so slightly. It is extraordinarily difficult for groups of backbench MPs to make much of a difference on most legislation, partly because of the way the debate is structured, partly because of the strictures of party that's a very big thing to align with the opposition to vote something down that the government wants, and partly because just the sheer level of work and intensity required to do it is extremely difficult to fit in with all the other duties. So there's a whole load of reasons why MPs don't engage very well with the detail of lawmaking. It's one of the things that the House of Commons is just really not very good at. You know, you do. I can remember my O-level British Constitution, and my God, even that dates me, where you would talk about the duties of the Commons were to authorise government expenditure, scrutinise the executive, the work of ministers, and go through the detail of legislation. And we blithely talk about line-by-line scrutiny of legislation. And it doesn't really happen in the Commons, either on the floor of the House of Commons or in committee. I think the committee stage of bills now is a kind of empty ritual. And you can wander into committees and see them allegedly going through the detail of a bill, and there will be speeches and there will be arguments made there, and particularly from the front benches. But you can also see some of the MPs at the back going through their correspondence as it happens. And it doesn't look as you would imagine the process to be from the kind of formal descriptions in constitutional textbooks at all. It looks perfunctory, because it is perfunctory most of the time.
And now, obviously, one of the things that has changed Parliament, and I'm not sure, I'm asking you this, I suppose, whether it was a short-term change or something more permanent, was Brexit. Because Brexit crossed party lines to an extent. I think people exaggerate that, because ultimately it was parties that triumphed rather than cross-party factions, and seemed to weaken the whip system. Firstly, just reflecting back on your time reporting on those days, you know, those halcyon days where BBC Parliament was getting higher viewership than MTV back in the start of 2019, what strikes you now in retrospect, and what, if any, long-term difference has that period made?
I think one of the things that happened there was that cross-party groups of MPs discovered how difficult it was to try and create initiatives across and between and around party structures. I can remember one of my little habits is recording interviews with people for the Today in Parliament programme I used to do in little back rooms in Portcullis House, the big parliamentary office building. And I can recall one day opening a door and blundering straight into the middle of the Labour-Remain conspiracy in sort of plenary session with people like Chukwuemeka and Chris Leslie of blessed memory, all looking up and looking absolutely horrified that a journalist had blundered into the middle of them, practically crossing themselves. Now, they were a group of, whatever you thought of their cause, pretty smart operators, but they couldn't quite get it together with colleagues across the House from different parties who shared their view on Brexit to get a Brexit alternative through. You remember there were the indicative votes on different options for Brexit, of various sort of shades of Brexit.
I do very well.
None of which were approved. They all were put to the House and they all lost and no one could quite muster a majority. And that's the most basic thing you have to do in the House of Commons is muster a majority.
Mm-hmm.
And it required superhuman levels of whipping to come as close as they did, I suspect. But it didn't quite work in the end, demonstrating that even a government as fractured as Theresa May's was could fight that kind of thing off, however powerful it looked from as it were, the ground level.
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, I remember talking to Labour MPs who said Theresa May's deal did everything that Corbyn said he wanted a Brexit deal to do, but it was a Tory deal, so they couldn't vote for it.
Well, that's not an unusual phenomenon. I mean, Nick Clegg's Lords Reform did most of what Labour Lords Reformers wanted, but they couldn't have it because it was a Lib Dem deal, and if they got it, the Liberal Democrats might have had something to show for the coalition years.
Yeah.
So never underestimate the level of party animus in all this, especially on something like that.
Yeah. Do you think our politics has become more polarised over the last few years?
Yes and no. You can find really quite startling levels of cross-party cooperation on kind of non-party issues, on things like target NHS targets for cancer treatment, for example, or all sorts of other issues that don't explicitly have a different coloured rosette on them. You can find people working across the House quite effectively to kind of get stuff done and get minor changes made. As soon as party seeps into it, completely different ballgame, and things can sour. And that will happen much more in the coming parliamentary session because we're now very much in the glide path to a general election.
Yeah.
So everything's an election issue and the pot is boiling a bit harder.
And I suppose the other big change, I mean, we've had COVID, we've had Brexit. The other thing that's relatively new now is social media. You know, there are some journalists who think WhatsApp's the greatest thing ever, partly because MPs can sort of screenshot messages and send them on. But have you noticed a difference because of social media?
I think that people are acutely conscious. If you're sitting in the press gallery of the House of Commons, you're looking down on the chamber, and you can see now, as you never used to see, these little glowing screens and people's faces sort of in a slightly sinister way uplit by their screens. It used to be that the main sort of item of data you got from looking down on MPs was seeing the sort of charting the recession of their hairline as old age told away. But these days you can see them all furiously tapping in, and a lot of them seem to be live tweeting things like Prime Minister's questions or other big events from the chamber itself. And so, it's a kind of new way of saying something. As well as going here in the chamber, you can also be going, gosh, isn't our leader wonderful? Wasn't that a brilliant point? Isn't the opposition totally flawed? And what idiots they're making of themselves? And you do it all on social media as a kind of online hallelujah chorus, while whichever party you're in is making its points before you in the chamber.
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Ora and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now. Do you think it's made a difference beyond that? I mean, you hear a lot about the abuse that particularly women MPs suffer.
Oh, absolutely.
Has it changed the way people... One of the things, for instance, I wasn't the only person who noticed this, lots of people wrote about it, was the fact that Jeremy Corbyn didn't use PMQs on its merits to have a debate with the Prime Minister. He used PMQs to garner a series of clips that the Labour Party could use on social media later that day. So it completely changed the way in which people viewed and used the chamber.
I think that, a lot of people are doing that now. And you'll see someone just making a sort of social media point. Harold Wilson back in the day used to sort of his press operation used to direct people to the line in his speech to the party conference that would be the
right.
key point that he wanted to get on the news. And this is a kind of very advanced cyber version of that, where people, you know, and you can see people kind of performatively winding up to deliver their sort of Facebook or whatever, Instagram clip or whatever it's going to be. And there they go. And I don't think that the theatrics around that is particularly good for Parliament, but I don't see any real way of stopping it.
Yeah.
It's just there. And people have to learn to deal with it. But it's another sense in which sometimes you're not seeing a real debate, you're seeing a paper debate. I mean, to Jeremy Corbyn's great credit, one of the things he tried to do, and which people actually noticed a bit, was that he tried to raise in the chamber issues that had been suggested to him online by people.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep.
Fred from Dagenham is very worried that he can't get an appointment with his doctor, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that would get mentioned. And polling did pick up that Prime Minister's questions had become a little bit more relevant as a result.
Interesting. Though it didn't last very long, that experiment, did it? He stopped after a few times, I think. But that's interesting that polls reflected it. One of the other big issues at the moment, I suppose, is money. You've had that Tortoise Media Sky report on the number of MPs that have second jobs and how much they earn. Sajid Javid recently suggested, one way around this was for MP, and it's very easy to suggest when you're leaving Parliament, that MPs should be paid more. So out of this, I suppose, come a number of questions. Firstly, do you have a problem with MPs having second jobs? Do you think that is...
I think it is very difficult to simultaneously argue that the Commons is a sort of hermetically sealed bubble and the real world doesn't reach into it.
Yeah.
And then stop one of the few ways in which the real world reaches into it. I think it is actively useful for MPs, for example, to work as doctors in emergency rooms during COVID, as Rosanna Ali Khan did, or to practice as dentists, or to be in any number of other things. The trouble is that I know I'm going to faff and sound tremendously indecisive on this. I can see the problem where people are earning telephone numbers for jobs that basically seem to be almost honorary.
Yep.
Then there's something a little bit suspect about that.
Well, in terms of the ability of those of their paymasters being able to influence them.
Well, if that's the thought behind it, now the latest set of parliamentary ethics reforms are intended to explicitly rule that out.
Yeah.
And MPs have contracts if they're doing public affairs work that says that they can't do anything that touches on Parliament.
Yeah.
Now, well and good, but you know, if there's a sort of implicit unspoken deal there, then there's a problem. And that gets you into a great deal of trouble.
And there's plenty of policy work you can do that would steer clear of those rules that would still leave you open to being a mouthpiece,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yes. I mean, it's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
I think I probably err a bit now on the side of saying that maybe second jobs shouldn't happen very much or must be extremely limited. One of the things, you know, you may find that some MPs decided that if that were to happen, they couldn't continue to be there. And would go. Maybe so be it. I think it's now so important that Parliament cleans up its ethical act.
Yeah.
That maybe other things have to go by the board.
So I think the problem with that surely is it's not, I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which Parliament needs to clean up its act. It's not just money, it's sort of sexual harassment, all sorts of things. Mm. And on top of that, there's the broader system, isn't there? So say Parliament cleans up its act, but appointments to this House of Lords are still seen to be awfully dubious. It won't really help. So it seems there's quite a lot of work.
Yeah, well, I mean, the appointments to the House of Lords are one of the things that actually any Prime Minister could deal with extremely easily. There's a thing called the House of Lords Appointment Commission, a quango, which in effect vets people.
Which is non-statutory at the moment.
By all means, put it on a statutory footing, but my feeling is that you know, a Prime Minister could simply announce anyone who's blackballed by HOLAC, I won't recommend their appointment to the Sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
And the Prime Minister has to recommend all appointments to the Sovereign. Yeah, even the ones from the other parties go through the Prime Minister. So if do that, it's fantastically difficult. I mean, is a successor Prime Minister then going to say, no, I think we need more crooks, we need more gropers, we need more tax dodgers in the House of Lords? No, that would be a very simple way of stopping it. There needs no legislation at all, just an announcement that that's what you're going to do.
And you don't think recent years have seen numerous examples of the kinds of behaviour that would refute that slightly good chap theory of politics that, you know, I don't want to be seen to be doing that, isn't really a break on bad behaviour anymore.
Well, I think it is for prime ministers. I think prime ministers are extremely careful about these things because there is a price to pay. I mean, yeah, in the long term, maybe years to go back in there, give it a statutory veto, but a very easy first step is just to have an outside body saying, no, you can't do that. This is almost a parallel argument to the current argument about the Office of Budget Responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Having an outside body saying, hang on a minute, this isn't a good idea,
yeah,
can get you quite a long way if it's a respected body that's seen to be fair.
Yeah, and it raises some very interesting questions about liberal democracy, doesn't it? About how far majoritarianism should go. Because, of course, one of the pushbacks you see, particularly from the right about the OBR, is they're not elected. Yeah. Why should they be able to constrain, albeit at the margins? I mean, the Bank of England is an even bigger case, isn't it?
Well,
because it actually makes policy.
Absolutely, but as you say, it's at the margins. Yeah, no one's saying the OBR can raise a majestic hand and forbid a chancellor from cutting taxes.
Yeah.
All you've got is a body that's going to come out with a few tables of statistics and say, hang on, we're not sure this is an awfully good idea. Doesn't mean the Chancellor can't do it. So it's a voice at the edge of the debate. It's not, a yes or no.
Now, you said earlier you were an avid reader of political memoirs. I'm not quite sure. Does that mean you no longer are an avid reader of political memoirs?
I am a bit. At one point, I thought my bandwidth was just being so crowded out by the sort of Brexit crisis, which just seemed to absorb every waking hour of my life at one point, I kind of gave up on and basically retreated into junk fiction on the way home on my homeward commute.
Yeah, I confess that's what I do.
I'll be sitting there with the latest paperback from Smith's. And that was the way it went. But I just absolutely love really good political memoirs. And there are a lot of really bad political memoirs. But, I still pick up and leaf through the Alan Clark diaries occasionally. There are some fabulous diaries from the Edwardian era, people like Duff Cooper. All those kind of people, and they are fascinating to read.
Have you read any of the recent ones? Rory Stewart, May?
I have the Rory Stewart staring accusingly up from my coffee table. I've read a little bit of it, but I'm kind of, since I've just stopped reporting on Parliament for a living, I'm kind of not quite taking the plunge on that one yet. I mean, Rory Stewart's a fascinating individual. His podcasts are genuinely very interesting.
They're not as interesting as this one.
Obviously, this is the reason I'm doing this podcast. This is the brand leader.
Hear that, Rory? Just a couple of questions on Parliament in general. One is, are you one of the people who thinks its processes are too complicated and archaic? I mean, I'm not a great fan of the kind of language they sometimes use that obfuscates and...
I think the central problem with a lot of the parliamentary processes is that they become ritualist, they become empty rituals.
Yeah.
Parliament doesn't do what it says on the tin anymore, to a great extent. The Commons doesn't properly scrutinise legislation, doesn't most of the time properly scrutinise the executive to anything like the degree that is the kind of constitutional expectation. The effective bits of Parliament, it seems to me, are the House of Lords in terms of scrutinising legislation. If you want to change a bill, forget about trying to change it in the Commons. If you're a lobbyist, go and talk to people in the House of Lords. Make your case there.
Mm-hmm.
And at report stage in the House of Lords, you may be able to muster a majority to do that, or at least persuade a minister that you have that majority, and then they make the change before you can force them to.
Right.
So that's there. Scrutiny of the executive is a great deal more effective in the select committees, I think, than it is... in the Chamber of the Commons at the dispatch box or otherwise, although not all select committees are that great. I think that some of them appear to be having a little bit of trouble making up the numbers. MPs increasingly, as the election looms, are preferring to be in their constituency when they can rather than in their select committees. And select committees' effectiveness depends critically on how good the chair is. And that can vary over time as well as over individuals. So,
okay, so I won't get started on the European Scrutiny Committee just yet. And do you think MPs get, what training do they get and is it efficient when they join? I'm fascinated by this. You come in, particularly you come in off the back of an election you didn't expect to win, which has happened a lot over the last sort of 4 or 5 years with these snap elections and unexpected swings. You turn up in Parliament. Parliament doesn't seem to put much on for these new people.
Well, as an incoming MP, there's any number of sort of workshops and sit down and listen sessions where people will advise you on how to do this, that, or the other. You'll get briefings on security. You'll get briefings on how to move, how to operate in the chamber. You'll get briefings and all sorts of stuff. But it's the problem with the job of an MP is you have to decide how you do it. And you can't do all the things an MP is supposed to do at the same time. If you're you can't be simultaneously a super councillor taking up every broken paving stone in your constituency and a stalwart of a select committee spending hours doing the background reading to quiz someone on the details of some really complicated policy issue, and then be a great interrogator in the chamber and be putting down endless amendments to the Widgets and Grommets Bill Committee and all the rest of it. So yeah, something has to give in all that. So you have to focus on one or two of those roles. And that's the difficult bit, is deciding what you want to be. And there will always be the imperative of making sure you survive in your constituency, dragging you back to...
I mean, the job itself is becoming far, far harder, it seems to me, because it's not just that you're meant to be in your constituency, but they want proof on Instagram that you were in your constituency. In fact, I mean, a couple of MPs, who I won't name, have said to me that during the course of a single day, they will change their clothes two or three times, which means that they can post photos on different days, claims. I mean, that's not a criticism. I mean, I just think if people expect them to work 9 days a week, they can't.
Yeah, yeah. You're expected to be omnipresent, and you can't be. And that's one of the really big difficulties in this. And just as the general election looms, there's going to be more and more of this gravitational pull towards your constituency issues. And less time. I mean, all right, if you get a moment of glory at Prime Minister's questions where you can get up and say, does the Prime Minister understand that the greatest issue confronting the land is the bypass in my constituency? And get that all over Instagram into your constituency. Well, fab, you know, job done. But you're also facing this kind of Greek chorus on social media saying, why didn't they do that? Why didn't they do this? The whole time, which will be, you know, be on you more or less whatever you do or say, and wherever you do it or say it.
If I said to you, you have unlimited power to make one reform to Parliament.
Oh, Lord.
The sort of grown-up question we like on this podcast.
I have, because I'm the sort of person who has fantasy parliamentary reforms. My fantasy parliamentary reform is to give the House of Commons the same standing orders as the House of Lords, which means that MPs would manage their own business, would determine their own timetable, would debate stuff until they were finished with it, rather than having to debate in the kind of straitjacket of arbitrary time limits. The problem with it is that that would never work, because the party animus in the House of Commons would make it impossible to have a kind of self-regulating system of the kind that you have in the House of Lords. So it's a very much a fantasy parliamentary reform. I would dial back to something a little bit more realistic. I would like to see perhaps the relevant select committee having a proper sort of confirmation or rejection process for the big quangocrats. You know, the governor of the Bank of England, the director
Like Senate here
or the BBC. Yeah, yeah. All the big industry regulators, members of the Monetary Policy Committee, people who have enormous influence behind the scenes in the British state, who are barely ever visible outside it, but who, as I say, just they wield enormous power.
Would that include judges?
I'm not sure I would do it to judges. I think that you get, once you get into a politically determined judiciary, you've got problems, as the Americans are discovering at the moment with their Supreme Court.
No, true, but is that any different to having a politically determined monetary policy? I mean, you could imagine you had, let's say, 8 years of a Corbyn government, which had the opportunity to appoint six members of the Monetary Policy Committee. That would have long-term lingering effects, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, but that's show business. You know, I wouldn't be particularly, you know, startled by that, because that happens all the time. You know, if there's a Labour government after the next election, it will be living for a while with the quangocrats appointed by Conservative governments. That's just the way the cookie crumbles. But I think giving Parliament some power not only means that there's a bit of control over who gets those jobs, but the people in them then have the authority of having been confirmed by Parliament. So when an industry regulator says, hang on, something's wrong here, they're doing so with a bit of authority and oomph behind them. And that matters too.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, the final few questions before we get on to a rather silly quick fire round. Is the BBC as able to carry out its role as the impartial public broadcaster as it was when you started?
It's far more regularly challenged, for a start.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. I mean, the days of someone still standing up in front of a camera as a kind of Freudian figure of authority, this is the truth as I lay it out before you.
Yeah.
And sometimes maybe, you know, that got them into a very perhaps establishment place. But what happens now is you say something on the BBC, and if people don't like it, you know, you find clips of it. It's happened to me. It's happened to pretty everybody in the BBC. Clips of you saying it that appear with lots of ridicule attached to them. Mm-hmm. And, what an idiot. He thinks that. You know, obviously working for the CIA. Obviously a puppet of the alien space bats who secretly control our nation, whatever it is. And you are looking over your shoulder a lot more. So it's become a lot harder to be impartial, because your impartiality is challenged at sort of 5 microsecond intervals the whole time. But that doesn't mean that it's not an important thing to do. I mean, there are, my experience of people in the BBC is that whether they get it right or whether they get it wrong, they are doing their damnedest to call it as they see it. And that's mm-hmm. all you can ask of any journalist in the end. And you know, I think there are certain people out there who find out what the party line is and mm-hmm. and certain outlets, which shall remain nameless for the purposes of this, who find out what the party line is, and then they lay that party line down with as much venom as they can muster. BBC doesn't do that. Mm. BBC is very, very careful about that kind of thing. And you can get called if people don't, internally, if people don't think you're getting it right.
Yeah, okay. Do you think the BBC provides enough of the right sort of coverage of politics and of Parliament?
I was very sad to see the demise of BBC Parliament. I can understand why it happened. When an organisation is having to make really nasty financial choices all the time, some things that people desperately love are going to end up being axed because those choices have to be made. I think it's a huge pity that BBC, and declare my own interest, I had a book review programme on BBC Parliament.
You did.
I did commentaries on great Brexit events, for example, on BBC Parliament. I mm-hmm. love doing it. And I think it's a pity that that stopped. But again, that's show business. You know, an institution under an enormous financial squeeze is having to make savings. And I can't find it in my heart to condemn the BBC for finding uncomfortable savings just because they're the ones I wouldn't necessarily have made myself.
Okay. Now, for our silly quickfire round, this is courtesy of Professor Phil Cowley at Queen Mary University of London, who suggested I just ask you a series of very quick questions. Don't think about this for too long. We won't hold you to your answers about bests. So what's the best speech you've heard in Parliament?
Steve Baker, the great Brexit organiser, spoke against a 10-minute rule bill, which was to stop MPs changing party without causing a by-election. Mm. And it contained the magnificent phrase, "I reserve the right to burn down my own party." It was a fabulous speech. It was a really good expression of what parliamentary democracy is all about, and that would have to be right up there. That's the one that springs to mind immediately.
Okay, best PMQs. So one that stands out.
I think it would have to be one of the recent Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer ones when he was really on the ropes for lying to Parliament. I can't quite place it in the sequence. It was a particularly venomous one, but it was the one where I think Starmer really trapped Johnson into a position where he wasn't telling the truth.
Okay. Best leader of the House?
Robin Cook.
Best constituency MP?
Ooh, Lord. An awful lot of people would say the late Sir David Amis taught them everything mm-hmm. they knew about constituency representation. I think in my time, the one who possibly built his career on being a fabulous constituency MP was Simon Hughes.
Okay, interesting.
In Bermondsey, where he held a natural Labour seat for decades. In the teeth of every election, the Labour Party said, this is the year we're going to get rid of Simon Hughes. It finally happened in 2015, but even then it was quite a close-run thing.
Yeah. And because you're a Bruce Springsteen, not best Bruce Springsteen song.
Jackson Cage from the album The River.
And because you're an avid cricket fan, who will India beat in the World Cup final that's coming up?
I think England will beat India, so I'm not quite sure I'm in the right place there.
Shame on you. Mark Darcy, thank you very, very much indeed for that.
Pleasure.